So yesterday's talk, of course, was about arguments for God's existence, and we focused specifically on what I call the Aristotelian proof of God's existence, of which Aquinas' first way is a variation. And we left off with the idea that such an argument gets us to the idea of God as a first cause of the existence of things, whose pure actuality with no potentiality, in particular no passive potentiality, to allude to a distinction that came up during the Q&A yesterday. Now, I mentioned that you can take Aquinas' five ways, or really any of the other classic arguments for God's existence, the ones you see in thinkers like Plotinus, or in Leibniz, in St. Augustine, in St. Anselm, any of the classic arguments of natural theology, including the ones that I defend in my book, Five Proofs of the Existence of God, as basically having two stages. And in the first stage, you argue for the existence of God understood in terms of some key description, such as being an uncaused cause, or as being an unmoved mover of the world, or as being an absolutely necessary being, or as being a supreme intellect, as in Aquinas' fifth way or what have you. And then the second stage is to argue that anything fitting that key description would have to have all of the traditional divine attributes, would have to be omnipotent, would have to be omniscient, would have to be eternal, would have to be necessary, would have to be unique, and so on and so forth. Okay. And so we only had time yesterday, to say a little bit about that second stage of an argument like the one that I gave yesterday. I sort of gestured in a very general way at how certain of the divine attributes would follow from a description of God as pure actuality. So today, we want to look at that question, the second stage of an argument for God's existence, in more detail. And as I mentioned to you yesterday, you wanted to keep that handout we looked at, or that little packet of handouts that I gave out, because we're going to return to it today. So hopefully you all follow that instruction and kept it. And you can take it out, because we're going to have reason to refer to it again. Now, there are many divine attributes traditionally attributed to God. And I just mentioned some of them. Omnipotence, or the attribute of being all-powerful. Omniscience, or the attribute of being all-knowing. Omniscience entails that there's something in God analogous to what we call intellect in us. Will is traditionally attributed to God. Immateriality, or being outside of the material world, being eternal or outside of space and time, and so forth. And we could spend really a lecture on easily on any of these divine attributes, and we don't have lectures to spend on all of them. So what I'm going to focus on is one of the divine attributes in particular, known as the attribute of divine simplicity. And this is among all the divine attributes, this is the one that, at first glance, seems the most philosophical and least removed from religious life, and the least significant to our understanding of God, especially the God of the Bible. And certainly when I was, when I was a young philosophy student and I was studying philosophy of religion, that was a particular interest of mine, even before I became an atheist. And then when I was an atheist for about 10 years, I was still interested in the subject of philosophy of religion, even from a negative point of view. The doctrine of divine simplicity always seemed to me a kind of weird, obscure, boring topic, something that wasn't worth spending a lot of time about. This idea that in God, and we talked about simplicity a little bit yesterday, in God there are no parts, there's no composition of any kind. Well, okay, why would anybody care about that? Why is it so important? But it turns out that when you examine the doctrine, it's really, in one sense, the key to properly understanding all the other doctrines. It's a doctrine that is given tremendous emphasis in the tradition of what we can call classical theism, on which I'll elaborate more a little bit later on. But where the classical theist tradition, it's grounded philosophically in the thought of thinkers in what Father Brent this morning talked about as the perennial philosophy tradition, thinkers like Plato and Aristotle and Plotinus. It's grounded in the biblical tradition. It's grounded in the church fathers. It's grounded in particular in thinkers like St. Athanasius and St. Augustine. You see it in the Christian tradition, represented by later thinkers like St. Anselm and St. Thomas Aquinas. You see it defended also in the Jewish tradition by thinkers like Moses Maimonides, and the Islamic tradition by thinkers like Avicenna and Averroes, in the Protestant reformers Luther and Calvin, in a couple councils of the Catholic Church. It's taught as de fide, as a binding doctrine of the faith, in the Fourth Lateran Council and the First Vatican Council. So divine simplicity turns out to be a very big deal, even though it's really, at least at first glance, the most philosophically abstruse and seemingly purely academic doctrine. Why is that? Well, as I say, it's really the key to understanding all the others, understanding all the other attributes of God properly anyway. So what does the doctrine say, and why is it so important? Okay, well, I've got here on the board a little description of what the doctrine says, and I'm going to elaborate on all this as we go along here. But just for starters, Doctrine of Divine Simplicity tells us that God is absolutely simple or non-composite, not simple in the sense, to pause here, not simple in the sense of being easy to understand. If anything, God is very difficult for our minds to understand, precisely because he's simple in the sense of the doctrine of divine simplicity. Why is that? I'll explain that. But to continue with my definition here, God is absolutely simple in the sense of being non-composite, i.e. in no way composed of parts of any kind. Whether we're talking about extended parts, or matter and form, or substance and attributes, or essence and existence, or genus and differentia, or any other sorts of parts, such as, to use the distinction I talked a lot about yesterday, actuality and potentiality. There's no distinction in God between actuality and potentiality. He's pure actuality with no potentiality. Okay, God is absolutely simple in the sense of being not composed of parts of any of these kinds or any other kinds. Now, I'm going to comment on each of these and explain what these distinctions are and why we cannot find in God any distinction between extended parts, matter and form, substance and attributes, and so forth. But to explain the significance of the doctrine, we can start by noting that the doctrine of divine simplicity is really crucial to safeguarding what you might call the ultimacy of God. The idea that God is ultimate in two key respects. First of all, that he is, as I put it last time, where the explanatory buck stops. God is the ultimate explanation of why anything exists at all other than himself. He's the absolutely rock-bottom fundamental level of reality on which everything else rests. That's central to the whole theistic tradition, certainly to the classical theist tradition represented by the thinkers to which I just alluded. If you don't have the doctrine of divine simplicity, you cannot have God understood to be ultimate in that sense. And God is also taken to be ultimate in the sense that he's absolutely unique. For the monotheist tradition, it's not just that there happens to be one God. As if there could have been 2 or 28 gods, and it just turns out that when they put out a job listing, wanted creator of the universe, long hours, good benefits, you know, one guy showed up or something. No, well, that's not the idea. The idea in the classical theist tradition is that it's not just that there happens to be one God with a capital G, but that there could not even in theory be more than one God. That there's something in the nature of deity, the nature of divinity, which entails the absolute uniqueness of God. So God is taken to be ultimate in that sense as well, and the doctrine of divine simplicity safeguards God's ultimacy in that sense as well, in a way that we're going to explain as we go along here. First, though, simplicity is crucial to God's being ultimate in the sense of being the fundamental explanation, the basement level of reality, you might say, or to change metaphors, the single hook on which everything else hangs. Insofar as I briefly noted last time, anything that is not simple, anything that is composed of parts, that is made up of parts of any kind, requires a cause. It requires those parts to be put together if the thing is going to exist, right? So if something's made up of parts, and therefore it will exist only insofar as those parts are brought together, it's got to be something outside it that combines those parts. Otherwise, the thing would be its own cause, but nothing can cause itself. That's incoherent. So if God were composed of parts, he would require a cause of his own, something that accounts for how those parts are combined, and in that case, he wouldn't be the first cause. But the whole idea of God is to be the ultimate cause of things. When we work to the existence of God by way of an argument like the Aristotelian argument to a purely actualizer that we set out last time, The whole idea is that we've arrived at something that is the ultimate explanation of why anything else exists. So if God is that, then he must not be composed of parts. He must be simple in that sense of being non-composite. And it's precisely because he is that he is so difficult for us to grasp, that God is radically beyond the things of our ordinary experience. And the basic idea here, on which I'm going to elaborate a little bit more later on, is that the way the human intellect works, the way we understand things, is by breaking them into their parts in various ways. So when you understand a simple mechanical device, you understand how an old-fashioned watch or a clock works, for example, the way you do it is either literally, physically taking it apart, or perhaps mentally at least, you identify that it's got these different parts. It's got gears and a mainspring and an hour hand and a minute hand and so forth. And so you understand how those parts interact with one another, how the mainspring pushes the gears and some gears push other gears, and how that ultimately pushes the hands. And it's by mentally or even literally physically decomposing or breaking the object down into its parts and then reassembling them, as it were, that you understand how the thing works. Or at a more abstract level, we understand a thing by breaking it down into its metaphysical parts. We identify its genus, or the general category that it falls under, and what differentiates it from other species, specific kinds of thing, in that general category. I'm going to come back to that a little bit later on, but that's what I mean here by the difference between genus and differentiate. So if we understand what it is to be a human being, in terms of Aristotle's classic definition, by saying a human being is a rational animal, what we're doing is we're saying, okay, here's what it is to be a human being. It's to fall under the general category of being a kind of animal. That's our genus, the more general category we fall under. And what makes us one species, or specific kind of thing under that genus, that's different from others, is that we've got rationality, unlike other animals. Okay, so we understand humanness, the human essence, what it is to be a human being, by breaking it down into its parts, animality and rationality. And we combine those, you got your human being. So whether we're talking about literal physical parts, we're talking about metaphysical parts, we're talking about the elements of the essence or nature of the thing, the way the human mind works when it tries to understand something, when it grasps something, is to break it down into its parts and see how they are assembled, as it were, whether in this crude literal physical way or in a more abstract way. But God is not composed of parts of any of those kinds. He's absolutely simple. He has to be, otherwise he wouldn't be the ultimate cause of things. Because he's like that, we can't understand God by breaking him down into his parts, as it were. And yet that's our normal mode of understanding. So our normal mode of understanding breaks down when it applies to God. And that's precisely why God ends up being incomprehensible to us. Meaning, not that we can't say anything at all about God. We can say a fair bit about God. Aquinas devotes hundreds of pages, obviously. And Plotinus and Aristotle and St. Augustine and Leibniz and all these thinkers in the tradition have a lot to say about the nature of God. And yet, for all that, God is still incomprehensible to us in the sense that we cannot fully take in God, nowhere near to the sort of extent we can take in or comprehend other things, that we can understand the nature of a geometrical figure in geometry, say, when you grasp the definition of a triangle as a closed plane figure with three straight sides, and you prove the Pythagorean theorem of right triangles and all sorts of other things. We have a kind of comprehension of those things and of other objects that we study in the sciences that we can never have, certainly not in this life, and apart from the beatific vision, we cannot have of God, precisely because he's not made up of parts that can be broken, that he can be broken down into, and that we can grasp, where we can grasp his nature by at least mentally breaking him down into his parts, as it were. So we get this superficially paradoxical result that God is extremely hard for us to understand precisely because he's so simple, right? He's difficult to understand because he's simple, where what I mean by simple in this case is, again, non-composite, not made up of parts, rather than easy to understand. That's a different sense of the word simple. Okay. Now, let's take a look at some of these specific ways in which God is not composed of parts. Starting with extended parts. What do I mean by that? Well, what I mean by that are basically just parts in the ordinary, everyday sense. So we think of physical objects as made up of parts. You take the chair you're sitting in, you might say, okay, well, that's made up of parts. There's like the back of the chair and the seat of the chair. and they're screwed into or bolted into the legs of the chair. And so you've got several parts there. You've got the plastic backing of the chair. You've got the metal legs of the chair. You've got the screws that hold it in. And so the chair is obviously composed of parts in that sense. Those are extended parts in the sense that they're extended in space. They have length, width, and depth. And material objects typically have that fundamental attribute of extension. And then, of course, the plastic unit itself that makes up the molding of that seat is composed of invisible parts, molecules, and the molecules of atoms, and atoms made up of subatomic particles. The same thing's true of the metallic legs of the chair, and so on for the rest of the parts. So those are all the extended parts in the sense in question here. And the idea is that, well, if God is made up of extended parts in that way, or extended parts of the sort of which our bodies are made, so we've got bones and muscles and skin and hair, and those organs are made up of tissues, which are made up of cells, which are in turn made up of molecules and so forth. God was made up of extended parts, parts that have extension, length, width, depth in that way. Then in an obvious way, he would require a cause of his own, just like all the physical objects of our experience do. There would have to be something distinct from him that brings those parts together so that God would exist. But if that's the case, he would not be the ultimate cause of things. He wouldn't be the purely actualizer. So God cannot be made up of extended parts. That's one reason why God cannot be a material thing. Material objects are extended. They've got physical parts. If God cannot have that because of divine simplicity, he cannot be a material thing. That's kind of a secondary lesson of this whole line of thought. Another sort of parts that we can distinguish is the matter and forms of which a thing is made. Now, take a simple example like a geometrical figure, like this triangle here, which I've drawn in red ink on the marker board, right? We've got here is a single object. Let's pretend it's a kind of substance. It's actually not. It's actually an accident or an attribute of the marker board itself, but just to simplify things, pretend that the triangle is itself a kind of substance. We can identify two fundamental parts of this thing, distinct from its extended parts, namely its matter and its form. This is a classic Aristotelian distinction, and Father Dominic yesterday morning talked about Aristotle's doctrine of the four causes, the formal cause of a thing, the material cause, the efficient cause, and the final cause. So the matter and form of a thing are its formal and material cause, where the material cause of a thing, its matter, is the stuff out of which it's made, in this case, red ink. And the formal cause of the form is the form or pattern, the structure that matter has taken on. In this case, it's taken on a triangular structure. It's also taken on the form or pattern of being red. Not all forms are shapes. All shapes are forms, but not all forms are shapes. So being red is a kind of form in this extended sense that Aristotle uses. Okay. Now, matter and form are distinct things, even though in a physical object, anyway, a purely physical object like a stone or a tree or water or gold or lead or something, they always go together. Form is not matter, and matter is not form. So the very same matter that currently exists in a liquid state in the tip of this pen can now take on the form of a triangle. I draw another one there next to the first. Or it can take on the form of dust particles when I erase that triangle and so forth. So the very same matter can take on different forms. And the very same form can exist in different bits of matter, as when I, in addition to that triangle, I draw a further one and yet another one and so forth. So there's obviously a sense in which you've got this very same form or pattern in three different bits of matter. So the same matter can exist in different, same matter can take on different forms. The same form can exist in different bits of matter. So form and matter are evidently distinct aspects of a thing, even though in a purely physical object they always go together. You never have matter without some form or other. It's either got the form of liquid or the form of a geometrical figure like that one or the form of dust when I erase it, or if I do some sort of chemical analysis on the dust and break it up, it's going to take on yet some other form or pattern. So matter's always got some form or pattern. And the former pattern of a physical object always exists in some matter or other, or at least in some mind which contemplates the former pattern. So matter and form typically go together, but they're distinct aspects of a thing. Okay. And they're not extended parts. I mean, I can literally pick up, you know, I can sort of rub my fingernail here on the some of that ink that makes up the edge of the triangle, and I get it under my nail, so I can get, pull out the extended parts, you might say, of the triangle. But the form and matter I cannot sort of pull out, right? I can't sort of pull out the matter of this triangle and leave the form there, sort of floating in a ghostly type way. And I can't take the form out, just leave the matter there amorphously with no form or pattern at all. Form and matter are not extended parts. They're a different kind of part, even though there's a clear sense in which they're physical parts. The point for our purposes, though, is that God cannot be composed of parts of that kind either, even that more abstract kind than extended parts, namely form and matter. Why not? Well, because if he were, then like the triangle, he would require a cause. There's got to be something that makes it the case that a certain bit of ink has taken on the form or pattern of a triangle, or that the form or pattern being a triangle has gotten into a certain bit of ink. And so on, for anything that is composed of form and matter, it's going to require a cause of its own, something outside it that accounts for how its form and matter get together. So if God were made up of matter and form, he would have a cause. But the whole point, the whole idea of God is the idea of the uncaused cause of things, the purely actual actualizer of things, the ultimate source of all reality, where the metaphysical buck stops and so forth. The real money that cashes out the IOUs, right? To use my other, perhaps silly analogy from yesterday. Okay, so if that's what God is, he cannot be composed of matter and form. He cannot be made up of parts of that kind. Now, even more abstractly, we have the distinction between substance and attributes, where you can think of a substance. Substance is actually a somewhat complicated metaphysical concept, but for our purposes here, we can just think of a substance as an independently existing thing, like a stone or a tree or a dog. Those would all be substances, as distinct from the attributes that characterize those substances. So there's a stone, and then there's the color of the stone, gray, say. There's the texture of the stone, its smoothness. There's the size of the stone. There's the shape of the stone. Perhaps it's oval in shape or what have you. Those are the attributes of the stone. It's oval shape, it's smooth texture, it's gray color, it's weight, and so forth. Okay. Now, attributes are distinct from substances insofar as attributes have a kind of dependency on substances. An attribute always exists in a substance in a way that a substance doesn't exist in some other thing. Attributes aren't freestanding, at least not in any sort of natural way, the natural order of things. You can throw a stone through a window, but you can't throw the color or shape of a stone through a window, right? You can put a stone in your pocket, but you can't put the texture of the stone by itself in your pocket, or the color of the stone by itself in your pocket. They don't exist in a freestanding way, only in the substance that has them. Okay. So the distinction between substance and attributes is another key metaphysical distinction, and a way in which a thing might be composed of parts. But here, too, we have a distinction that the doctrine of divine simplicity says cannot apply to God, because, again, if there was in God a distinction of parts even of this kind, he would require a cause. There would have to be something external to the substance and its attributes, in this case, that explains how those attributes get into that substance. Why it is that the substance has those attributes and not others, not more attributes or fewer or what have you. So if in God there was a distinction between substance and attributes, once again, he would require a cause outside himself. In that case, he would not be an uncaused cause, the first cause in the sense of the ultimate or primary cause. Now, that's not to deny that God has attributes. I mean, I just started out the talk mentioning that God has attributes. He's omnipotent. He's all-powerful. We're all-powerful. He's omniscient. He has intellect, will, and so forth. But precisely because he's absolutely simple, the doctrine of divine simplicity tells us that whereas in us, omniscience, omnipotence, well, we don't have omniscience, but in us, knowledge, limited knowledge, our limited degree of power and so forth, our limited degree of goodness, whereas in us, those are distinct attributes. In God, there must be a sense in which they're all identical. They're the same thing looked at from different points of view. In God, God's omniscience, his omnipotence, his eternity, his immutability, his goodness, are really all the same thing looked at from different points of view, we might say. Now I'm going to say, so it's not denying that God has attributes. It's denying that there's a distinction within God between his attributes. I'm going to come back to that a little bit later on. Okay. There also cannot be a difference in God between his essence and his existence. And this is something that we talked about yesterday. So you recall that the essence of a thing we can characterize as what a thing is. Versus its existence, which is the fact that a thing is, if it is indeed existent. All right. Believe it or not, that's an A. I have to really improve my penmanship here. Rewrite that a little bit. Okay. The essence of a thing is what it is, and the existence of a thing is that it is, the fact that it is, if it indeed is an existent thing. So, to illustrate this idea with the examples I used yesterday, as I noted, if you describe for a child who had never heard of these creatures before, the essence or nature of what it is to be a lion, the essence or nature of what it is to be a Tyrannosaurus Rex, and the essence or nature of what it is to be a unicorn, and he had a sufficiently, sufficiently powerful memory and comprehension that he, you know, once you explain these things to him, he remembered all the details and so forth. But then he said, okay, now, of these creatures, one of them still exists. You can see it at the zoo. One of them used to exist but has gone extinct, and one of them never did exist but is legendary. Now tell me which is which. He would not be able to tell you. Knowledge of the essence would not be sufficient to tell him that lions still exist, that T-Rex used to, but has gone extinct, and that unicorns never did. So the existence or lack thereof of these things is some additional factor distinct from the essence or nature of these things. Okay, so we talked about that distinction yesterday. Now, for thinkers like Aquinas, it's the fact that there are in the things of our experience, there is in the things of our experience, put it that way, a distinction to be drawn between their essence and existence that accounts for the fact that there can be more than one of them, that we have a kind of plurality. Let me move this a little bit. Maybe I should just move the board instead, because I want to draw on this side of it. So we've got, to stick with my triangle example here, we've got the essence or form of being a triangle, say, and I'll draw the dotted line to indicate what I'm talking about here, is an essence or nature. Spill. That's great, thank you. Okay, so there's the essence of being a triangle, let's call it triangularity, being a closed plane figure with three straight sides. And then there's this individual triangle, which is an instance or example of that essence or nature. There's this individual triangle, different in certain respects, different color. There's this third individual triangle, the right triangle. These are all individual instances or examples of this general pattern of triangularity. Okay. Now, what they have in common is an essence or nature. They all have the same essence or nature, the essence or nature of being triangular. But there are different existing things, you might say, that have that same essence or nature. And for Aquinas, it's the distinction between essence and existence that makes it possible for there to be a kind of plurality, you might say, in that general category of things, triangles. A plurality of triangles. This triangle distinct from that one. Their essence or nature is the same. What they are is the same. But their existence is distinct. That's why if I destroy one of these triangles, its existence, you might say, is gone. But the other triangles don't go with it because they have their own distinct existence. They have their own distinct, as Aquinas likes to put it, active existence. Okay. So the idea is that the essence and existence distinction is one way to understand how it's possible for there to be more than one thing of a kind. Okay, there can be more than one thing of a kind if there's a difference between what they are and the fact that they are. What they are is the same, but their existences are distinct. They're distinct existent examples or instances of the same essence or nature. Okay. Now, in God, there is no distinction between essence and existence because given that, as I noted last time, for Aquinas, essence considered by itself is merely potential. So you take something like a unicorn, if we think of a unicorn as having a kind of essence or nature, it's a merely potential creature. There are no unicorns and never were. So at most, it exists as a possibility in the divine mind, something that he might create, but he has not, in fact, decided to create unicorns, say. Okay. So the essence or nature of a unicorn considered by itself is merely potential. Unicorns are actual only when existence is added to that essence or nature. So in God, because he's pure actuality with no potentiality, there cannot be this distinction between essence and existence. And indeed, since anything in which there is a distinction between essence and existence is going to require a cause, something outside it that adds existence, as it were, to its essence. If in God there was a distinction between his essence and his existence, he would need a cause of his own, in which case he wouldn't be the first cause. He wouldn't be the purely actual actualizer. So there must in God be no distinction between his essence and his existence. As Aquinas puts it, God doesn't simply have existence. He is subsistent existence itself. His very essence or nature is to exist, you might say. His very essence or nature is pure actuality. It's a sort of different way of saying what Aristotle says, using the language of pure actuality with no potentiality. Okay. So, there cannot be in God a distinction between his essence or nature and his existence, or he'd require a cause of his own. So, again, in God, essence and existence must be identified. His very essence is his existence. They collapse, as it were, in God, into a single unity, a single reality. But precisely because there is in God no distinction between his essence and his existence, this is one way to understand, for a writer like Aquinas, why there cannot be more than one God. Where we have an essence-existence distinction, we can make sense of there being different existing instances or examples of the same essence or pattern. But where that distinction collapses, where we have no distinction between a thing's essence and its existence, we have no way of distinguishing, even in theory, more than one member of that category, more than one instance or example of that essence or nature. Okay, so for that reason, that's one reason for Aquinas why God is, it's not just that there happens to be one God, but God is of his very essence, you might say, unique. There cannot even in principle be more than one thing that has the divine nature. Because for there to be more than one thing having a certain nature, there has to be a distinction in it between its essence or nature, which every member of the category has in common, and then the different existing things that have that common essence or nature. When that distinction collapses, we have no way to even make sense of the difference, of the possibility of there being different individual things having that same essence or nature. And so there cannot be different individual things having the nature of God. There can only be one. There can only be one God. Now, another way to see this involves this last distinction that I drew between genus and differentia, where we can't make that distinction either within God. Cannot identify those parts in God either. This requires me freeing the board up a little bit, so let me erase all this. Hopefully you already copied that. You know, oh, I didn't copy it yet. You had 20 minutes. Okay. So, as I noted a few moments ago, genus and differentia have to do with the component parts of the essence or nature of the thing. When we, for Aristotle and for Aquinas, when we define something, and once again I'll take human beings as my example, when we define it in the strict sense, in the sense in which in traditional logic we talk about defining a thing, we're defining a kind of species, a specific kind of thing, a specific class of things. And we're defining that species. The word species is related to the word specific. So we're defining a species or a specific class of things. And we're defining it in terms of a genus and a differentia. We say, for example, a human being is a rational animal. And of course, whether this is the best way to define a human being, I think it is, but that's something, obviously, that's a matter of philosophical controversy. But put that aside for the moment, because I'm just using this as an illustration. Okay. We define a human being as a rational animal. By identifying a genus that human beings fall under, a more general category, hence the genus, and what differentiates this species in the genus from other species in the same genus. And that's what rational is here, rationality is. It's the differentia.
Okay, human being is a rational animal. When we give this definition, when we're identifying the essence of what it is to be a human being, the essence of this species or specific class of things, we do so again by identifying the genus or more general class that this species falls under. And what differentiates it, sets it apart from, makes it different from other things, other species in the same genus, in the same more general class of things.
Pictorially, you can represent it this way. So we've got the general class or category being an animal, and then we're identifying human beings as a species or more specific class or category of things in that genus. But anytime you've got a distinction between a species and the more general category of genus under which it falls, there must be some other species in the genus. Otherwise, you would have no, there'd be no point in dividing or distinguishing the species from the genus. And of course, there are lots of animals, lots of things that are animals but are not human beings. There are reptiles and birds and fish and so forth. So we want to ask, okay, well, what differentiates, what makes this a different species from other species or specific kinds of things in the same genus? And this Aristotelian definition tells us, oh, well, the answer is rationality. Human beings are animals. We take in nutrients, we grow, we reproduce, we've got sense organs, we've got self-movement or locomotion, we've got appetites or inner drive, so all those things make us a kind of animal. But on top of that, we've got rationality and choice. We've got intellects and wills. And that's our differentia. That's what differentiates us from other kinds of animals. So, human being is an animal of the rational type. Okay. It's rationality that sets us apart from other species in this genus.
Why couldn't you have the rational as a genus and then animal as a differentia?
I'm gonna bracket off. It's a side issue that has to do with the adequacy and reasons for this specific definition of human beings. But again, I'm just using this definition as an example to illustrate the distinction between genus and differentia, rather than saying about human nature per se. So I'll just bracket that off for a moment. Okay. So human being is a rational animal. We can distinguish between then rationality and animality as differentia and genus, respectively. Okay. Now, one point to make is that if God were composed of parts in this sense, because what we have here are parts of an essence. The essence is the essence of a species, a specific kind of thing, and it has its component parts, and obviously I'm not talking about physical parts here, I'm talking about metaphysical parts. It has its component parts, rationality and animality. And if God were composed of parts in that way, you could distinguish within God between the genus or general category he falls under and what differentiates him from other things in that genus, then once again he would require a cause in just the way human beings do. There's a distinction between animality and rationality, and therefore we want to ask, well, how do they get combined? In the case of animality and rationality, after all, they could exist, and they do exist apart from one another. So you have animals that are not rational, and you have rational creatures, namely angels, that are not animals. In human beings, you've got both. We've got a foot in both worlds, as it were. We're this strange mashup of angel and ape, as it were. Right? How does that happen? Well, anything that's like that, it's got these distinct parts, requires a cause. There's got to be something outside it that accounts for how those things get together. So if in God there was a distinction between genus and differentia, once again, God would require a cause. There has to be something outside him that accounts for how his genus and differentia get together. But God's the uncaused cause. He's purely actual. He's the basement level of reality that holds up everything else. So there can't be anything metaphysically more fundamental than him that accounts for him. Therefore, he cannot have parts, even of this very abstract sort. Okay. Now, another point to be made about a point to be made by way of this distinction between genus and differentia has to do with God's uniqueness. Once again, the idea that there is and can be, even in principle, only one God. When we come to physical things like stones and trees and dogs and cats and so forth, and human beings for that matter, because being rational animals, unlike angels who have no animality,
We're animals, so we have physical bodies. We've got material organs and everything that goes along with that. We want to ask, okay, what is it that makes the case that there's more than one member of any class of physical things? After all, if the objects I drew on the board are all triangles, or if the objects we see outside the window there are all trees, there's a sense in which they're all the same. They have the same tree-like nature, you might say, or stone-like nature, or what have you. So if their essence or nature is the same, how can there be more than one of them? What distinguishes them? What distinguishes this particular instance or example of the nature of being a tree from that specific instance or example of the nature of being a tree? And Aquinas' answer to this is that what individuates trees or stones, what makes them distinct individual members of the same common essence or nature, is matter. Matter, Aquinas tells us, is the principle of individuation. It's what makes it possible for there to be different individual things, different individual physical entities, having the same nature, in the same species. So, the way there can be different human beings, there can be Socrates, there can be Plato, there can be Donald Trump, there can be Hillary Clinton, and so forth. The way there can be different individual human instances of the same general species, they all have in common rational animality, of the same class, is that there are different bits of matter, you might say, in which that essence is embedded, in which it's embodied. It's matter that's the principle of individuation, or the principle that accounts for there can be different individual members of the same species. Okay. Now, what about non-material substances, angels? I mean, that's a category of thing for Aquinas, right? So there's the general category of being an angel. And to be an angel is essentially to be a rational substance of a non-animal nature. An angel, as Aquinas understands it, it's not literally something with wings and the long golden hair and the white robes and so forth, but you got to draw something in the kids' books, right? But you can't draw a disembodied intellect. Right? So you got to draw something, so you draw that. Aquinas would say, well, angels don't really look like that. They don't look like anything because they're not physical objects. They're entities of pure intellect, and will follows on intellect. Will is rational appetite, or an intellect's disposition or inclination toward certain actions, say. So angels are creatures of pure intellect and will. They're minds without matter, minds without bodies, as it were. That's what it is to be an angel. Is there more than one angel? Sure. You've got Gabriel, you've got Michael, and so forth. So you do have distinct members of the angelic genus, as it were. But here's the interesting thing for Aquinas. In the case of angels, precisely because they are immaterial, they're not embodied, they're incorporeal, they don't have bodies the way we do, they're not material objects in any way, there's no principle of individuation within an angelic species the way there is within the human species. So there's the general category of human being, and there's Socrates who's one human being, Plato who's another, and so on and so forth. But you can't draw that sort of distinction in the angelic realm. So where does that leave, say, Gabriel or Michael? Now, I just got done telling you angels don't literally have wings, and so, but I got to draw something. So I'll draw the little dotted line here. A little halo. Okay. For Aquinas, an angelic name like Michael, say, it names not only Michael, the individual angel, but also an angelic species. Michael, you might say, is the unique member of his own species under the genus angel. There's the genus or general category angel, and then there's specific things under that general category. Remember, a genus is a more specific category, a genus is a more general category, a species is a more specific class or category. So, are there more specific classes under the genus angel? Aquinas would say, sure, there are. But because there's no matter in the angelic realm, there's no way to distinguish one member of the species from another. So each species of angel is also a unique angel. It has a unique member, right? It's as if imagine the human race consisted of a single person, Adam. And imagine that for some reason, there couldn't be more than one human being. Then you might say, human being would name not only the class, but the person, Adam himself. Or Adam would name not just Adam, the particular human being, but the whole species. He would be it. Now, that's not, in fact, the case with human beings, because we've got bodies. We're made of matter, so there's a principle to individuate us. There can be different human beings because they're different bits of matter that take on that same pattern. But you don't have that with angels. And so, in the case of an angel, each angel is the unique member of its own species, as it were. So, with human beings, you can distinguish members of the species, just like you can distinguish different species in the same genus. In angels, you cannot distinguish different members of the species, even though you can distinguish different species within the same genus. Now, when we get to God, you can't even do that much. The only reason you can do it with angels is you still have a genus differentia structure, right? You've got a general category and something that differentiates these members, these species, in the same general category, even if you can't go on to distinguish members of the species. Here, you can distinguish species in the genus and then distinguish members of the species. With human beings, you can do that. With angels, you can't do that. You can't distinguish different members of the species, but you can still distinguish different species in the same genus. You've got a genus differentia distinction. But you don't have that with God. There is no distinction in God between genus and differentia because he has no parts. It's the doctrine of divine simplicity. That means there's no way to distinguish one species of God from other species of God. And that means there just couldn't be more than one species of God. That God is not a member of a species or really of a genus, for that matter. Got to get rid of these little lines that indicate that membership relation. God is utterly unique in that sense, or for that reason, because there's no genus differentia distinction to be made within him. So again, for a writer like Aquinas, because of the doctrine of divine simplicity, there cannot even in principle be more than one God. The only way there can be in principle more than one thing is if you've got some way to distinguish them, to individuate them. In the case of physical objects, matters the principle of individuation. In the case of angels, you can't distinguish them that way, so you can't distinguish more than one member of the species, but you could at least distinguish species, each with its unique member. But that's because there's a genus differentia distinction. There's the genus angel, and then there's this angel, and what differentiates it from some other angel. But where you don't even have that, you can't draw a distinction in the class or category, which means it isn't really a class or category at all. It's its own thing. Deity, godness, as it were. And there cannot even in theory be more than one. This is the deep metaphysical reason for monotheism. There could not in principle be more than one God. And it follows in the classical theist tradition from the basic idea of seeking ultimate explanations. When you set on the way to ultimate explanations, the only place you can possibly arrive at is something that is absolutely simple or not made up of parts. Anything that's not like that, you haven't hit bottom yet. You haven't got to the ultimate explanation. When you get to the ultimate explanation, it's going to be something that's absolutely simple, but precisely for that reason, it's going to be absolutely unique as well. So monotheism is a logical and metaphysical outcome of the quest for ultimate explanation. The very quest that science itself is engaged in. We're trying to trace things down to deeper and deeper and deeper principles or laws of physics. But as long as you're still at something that could have failed to exist, could have been otherwise, is in some way composed of parts, you haven't hit bottom yet. If you pursue science or any other inquiry as far as you can take it, you're inevitably going to get to something that's absolutely simple or not made up of parts, and it's going to be something that's absolutely unique precisely for that reason. Okay. So, in this way, divine simplicity preserves God's ultimacy in these two senses, that he's the ultimate cause of everything else, and that he's utterly unique. There cannot even, in theory, be more than one God. Okay. Now, one way in which this is relevant to current debates, so you consider the arguments of the new atheists. Ever heard of these guys? So Richard Dawkins is the sort of the high priest, as it were. He's the monarch, the ruler of the new atheist kingdom and so forth. Dawkins, in his book, The God Delusion, helpfully tells us in his index, I can't remember, the entry is something like argument, comma, author's main,
author's main argument, something like that. So he takes great pride in this. Though it's an argument he really got from David Hume. But the argument is, well, look, if you're going to say that the universe must have had a designer, must have had some creator, and the reason is the universe is really complex, well, surely the creator's mind must be really complex as well. Must be, if the world's complex, whatever made it must be complex. And so if the world needs a cause, then God would need a cause, because he's complex. But if you say God doesn't have a cause, why not just say the world doesn't have a cause either? So we've refuted any sort of first cause argument, any sort of design argument, with, once again, an objection, which, as I put it last time, could have been arrived at by a 5-year-old kid. Okay, so Dawkins wants to say, if God is complex, he'd need a cause of his own. So he'd be in the same boat as the universe, and so if the universe has to have a cause, so would God. But if you say God doesn't, then the universe must not either. Where he goes wrong is in assuming that any of the great thinkers in the classical theist tradition would have disagreed with him. They would all have agreed with him. Aristotle, Plotinus, Thomas Aquinas, St. Augustine, they would all say, you're absolutely right, Dawkins. If God was complex, he would need a cause. That's why he's not complex. That's why we say he must be absolutely simple or non-composite, not made up of parts. Precisely because of that sort of objection, he would not be the ultimate explanation. And so Dawkins goes wrong is in assuming that the theist tradition thinks of God as being complex. That's the fundamental mistake. He simply hasn't done his homework. That is not only part of the tradition, that's core to the tradition. And it's the key, as I say, to understanding all the other divine attributes. However we understand God's being omniscient or all-knowing or all-powerful or omnipotent or all-good, it cannot involve the attribution to God of parts. That would violate simplicity. That would violate God's status as the ultimate and unique explanation of things. Okay. Now we'll come to some questions in a little bit. But before we do, how are we doing on time?
Maybe you wrap it up in the next 3 minutes.
And then
maybe a question.
Oh, 3 minutes?
5 minutes,
okay. And we'll see what I can do. I think I got, because I'm only now turning to the handout. Okay, so let's turn to this handout, because I've now given you an exposition of what the doctrine of divine simplicity says, but it's also a doctrine that's, especially these days, very controversial. And in particular, it's a doctrine that marks, I would say, the main point of contention between two conceptions of God, which have, in the recent literature in philosophy of religion, come to be labeled classical theism, on the one hand, to use this expression that I've referred to several times, and on the other hand, what you might call neo-theism, or another label sometimes used is theistic personalism. Okay. Classical theism is this classical tradition of theology that has its roots in the Bible and in ancient Greek philosophy, and that you see in the church fathers and in pagan philosophers like Aristotle and Plotinus, and again in these medieval philosophers in all three of the great traditions, Jewish, Christian, and Muslim, Aquinas, Avicenna, Maimonides, and so on and so forth. Neotheism, that's a term that is used by Norman Geisler, who died very recently, just literally, I think, a few days ago, a week or two ago, who's a Protestant Thomist. So he's a devotee of Thomas Aquinas, but, you know, unlike most Thomists, he's not coming from the Catholic tradition, he's coming from the Protestant tradition. Neotheism is a trend of thought that reacts against classical theism. It's also sort of called theistic personalism. That's a term used by Brian Davis, who's a contemporary Thomist philosopher of religion, and on the handout there I make reference to one of his books, which is, by the way, his book, Introduction to Philosophy of Religion, it's really the best introduction to that subject that's on the market right now. So anyone who's interested in pursuing all these questions in greater depth, I recommend, if you want a kind of overview of all the positions that have been taken, all the main arguments, you want to look at Brian Davis's book. Davis calls this view theistic personalism, and whatever you want to call this view, it's a trend in recent philosophy of religion, the last 30 plus years or so. You see it in writers like Alvin Plantinga, very well-known philosopher of religion, Richard Swinburne, process theologians like Charles Hartshorn and John Cobb and so forth. So a diversity of views are represented by this label. But you could say it defines itself in opposition to classical theism and in opposition to divine simplicity in particular. And there are several beefs that the neo-theist or theistic personalist has against classical theism.
But the doctrine of divine simplicity, I would say, is the main one. The idea being, well, if God is actually simple or without parts, then it seems like God is like an abstract object. It's like a philosophical construct, and not a personal God to whom we can relate as a heavenly Father, or a God who could become incarnate in Christ, and so on and so forth. He would be a God who's not religiously available. It wouldn't really be the God of the Bible, so it's claimed. Now, I mean, one evident problem with this claim is, well, if that's true, and it's often presented as more obviously true, that an absolutely simple God couldn't be the God of Christianity, couldn't be the God of the Bible, then it's rather remarkable that this wasn't evident to St. Augustine, St. Athanasius, St. Thomas Aquinas, St. Anselm, and all these other thinkers, in not only in the Christian tradition, but the Jewish and Islamic traditions, all of whom insisted on divine simplicity, who would say it's perfectly compatible with the conception of God we see in the Bible when that's properly understood. There are a number of objections raised against this idea, and what I do here on the handout is summarize some of the main ones and the sorts of responses that the classical theist, the defender of divine simplicity, would give against these objections. And I'm summarizing here some points that are made in Brian Davis's book, particularly in chapter 8 of the most recent edition of his Introduction to Philosophy of Religion. So I commend that text to anybody who's interested. I suspect I'm close to using up my 5 minutes here. So maybe that would be a natural place to break. I thought I was going to be able to get through all this, and I'm not going to be able to. But maybe some of this can come up in the Q&A if we have a little bit of time for Q&A. And, of course, it can also come up in the quadlibital discussion this afternoon. Okay, so I'll end with that. And are we going to have, like, a little bit of Q&A, or are we at it? Okay. All right. I'll start in front of you.
In the genus differentia distinction,
yeah.
When we say, like, human being and divine being, or human person, divine person, how is that not making the distinction in a way that would be problematic?
Right. So one of the keys to understanding the right way to approach that question, and a lot of the other objections that I summarize on that handout, is the idea of the analogical use of language, which Aquinas puts heavy emphasis on. So in Aquinas, there are three basic ways that we use language. There's the univocal way. I'm going to give you the so-called doctrine of analogy in 1 minute here. Okay, so there's the univocal way, there's the equivocal way, and there's the analogical way to use language. Now, when we use terms univocally, we're using them in the same sense. And to use an example I used last time, when we talk about a baseball bat and a cricket bat, though of course they're of different shapes, they have somewhat different uses in the game. We're essentially using the term bat in the same sense, or the univocal, in a univocal way. We talk about baseball and cricket. On the other hand, we talk about a baseball bat as opposed to the sort of bat that flies around your attic, or the sort of bat that flew in Bruce Wayne's window when he was trying to decide what sort of superhero to become. Imagine someone throwing a baseball bat into the room. Batman in the sense of baseball. Okay. You've seen the movie The Warriors and the Baseball Furies. They're kind of dressed. Okay, I'm really digressing on this stuff. Okay. So there we're using terms equivocally. A baseball bat and a bat in the sense of a flying animal, there's no relationship at all there between those two things. Totally disconnected meanings. Now, for Aquinas, when we use language about God, we're properly understood not using language in either a univocal or an equivocal way. We're using it in what's really a kind of middle ground way, analogical usage. And it's illustrated by, to use an example I gave last time, a term like good. That's a paradigmatically analogical term. So we talk about the goodness of a human being, Mother Teresa say. We talk about the goodness of food, like a nutritious meal. We talk about the goodness of a book we're reading, say. We're reading St. Thomas. This is really good stuff, right? Now, we're not using good for Aquinas in exactly the same way or a univocal way. The goodness of a book is very different from the goodness of food, which is very different in turn from the goodness of a human being, the moral goodness of a human being. So we're not using language univocally. But we're not using it equivocally either. The difference between the goodness of food and the goodness of a human being is not as radical or complete as the difference between a baseball bat and the flying animal. Instead, we're using language in an analogical way. We're stretching language, you might say.
We're saying there's something in the goodness of a human being which is analogous to the goodness of a book, which is in turn analogous to the goodness of food, say, though they're not exactly the same thing. Now, when we use language about God, we are similarly using language analogically. We're saying that there is in God something that's analogous to what in us we call goodness, something that's analogous to what in us we call power, something analogous to what in us we call knowledge. But it's not the same thing. Any more than the goodness of a meal is the same thing as the goodness of a morally virtuous human being. There's an analogy there, but it's not the univocal use of language. That's why we have knowledge, we say God has knowledge, or to take your example, we say we are persons, and God is personal, he has intellect and will, he's not some impersonal force. But whatever we mean, we call God, we describe God as having knowledge, it's not knowledge in the way we have it. For example, it does not and cannot involve having, you know, impressive powers of perception. God's got really good eyesight. He sees everything. Unlike us, we can only see a little bit. We can't see all the detail of the chair. We can't see its molecular structure. But God's eyes, they're not like 20/20. They're like a million, whatever. That probably doesn't make sense. That's not the way God knows. It's not by having eyesight, but just better eyesight. It's not by being able to reason very quickly, the way a very clever person. It's not like doing math at Rain Man levels, you know, even beyond that. It's a different kind of thing altogether. There's something in God that's analogous to knowledge in us, but it's not the same as what we call knowledge in us, even though it's not totally disconnected either. We're stretching language the way we do physics. And we get to the very small-scale structure of matter. We start describing things that in some ways are wave-like, in some ways particle-like. How can something be both? Well, in the ordinary usages of those terms, they can't be. But we're not describing wave-like and particle-like behavior in the ordinary sense. We're stretching language, using it analogically. Or, to use another example I gave last time, we talked about curved space and relativity. We're stretching the meaning of the term curvature, because ordinarily it's objects in space that we think of as curved. So we take space itself to be curved. We're using language in an analogical way. And Aquinas says, well, he would say, if you're familiar with those theories, the reason we have to stretch language when we get to cases like that is precisely because we're engaging in scientific explanation that's as fundamental as it can be. We're going well beyond the realm of ordinary experience. When we get to the uncaused cause of things, who's absolutely simple, we're going even further than that. Now we've really got to stretch language. We're stretching it so far, though, that it starts to make it intelligible how in God, his power, his wisdom, his goodness, his knowledge could be the same thing. So we're not using those words in exactly the way we use them, we apply them to us. Incidentally, analogical language here, it's important to understand, is not metaphorical. When I say this is a good book and Bob is a good person, I'm not speaking metaphorically, even though I am speaking analogically. So analogy is not the same thing as metaphor. For Aquinas, we call God powerful or knowledgeable or good. We're speaking literally. We're just not speaking univocally. We're speaking analogically. Okay.
We have time for it. Yeah, one more question.
Okay, yeah.
Thank you. How would you refute the first part of Dawkins' claim, which is that if the world is complex, then the creator's mind must be complex?
Well, I would say he is, for one thing, he's simply ignoring the nature of the sort of argument by which Aristotle or Plotinus or Thomas Aquinas gets to God. I mean, he would say, these writers would all say, well, when we're engaged in ultimate explanation, we're actually taking things down to a simpler or less complex level. Indeed, Dawkins himself in one way knows that, because he knows that the way in which physics works, for example, is precisely to unify phenomena by identifying laws, very simple laws or principles that govern radically diverse kinds of things. But suddenly, when we're talking about theology, Dawkins thinks that theological explanations work in a different way, that they explain the complex in terms of the more complex. And, you know, what I think writers in the classical theist tradition would say is, well, wait a second, you guys know that's not the way it works in science. That's not the way it works in theology either. The ultimate explanation must be simple. So, for that reason, however we understand and model God's relationship to his creation, it cannot be understood as exactly like the relationship between a Thomas Edison and some machine he constructs, where Edison is, you know, more complex in a sense. His brain is more complex, his intellect is more complex than the light bulb that he creates or some other mechanism he creates. That's not the right way to understand it. Now, in fact, when you work out the nature of intellect, nature of what it is to have a mind,
for a writer like Aquinas, it turns out to be a deep mistake to think that the more advanced or intelligent a mind is, the more complex it is, in the sense of like more intricate interlocking parts. In fact, it's the opposite of that. So he thinks of angelic minds, for example, as in a sense simpler than ours. That doesn't mean dumber than ours. It actually entails that they're more intelligent than ours. Because you can see they do more with less, you might say. Whereas we have to understand the world by breaking it down to a diversity of concepts. In an angelic intellect, it can grasp a larger collection of things by way of a single concept, say. And then we get to God, and sort of max out that sort of movement. That's all very general, but and it's fleshing it out would require getting into the nature of intelligence in more detail. But Dawkins basically just doesn't know the first thing about the metaphysics of theism and of mind as it's understood by these other writers. Now, he might say, yeah, but they're all wrong. And I would say, well, maybe they're wrong and maybe not, but wouldn't it be good to actually know what they're saying before you say they're wrong? And he doesn't even get that far.